I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Colonel Ehud Diskin, author of the best-selling novel of Israel's birth, Lone Wolf of Jerusalem. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, and we'll welcome two new young representatives of Israel, our Shinshiniot, Ron Benekot, and Rotem Rappaport. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. We're now in the last couple of weeks of the Jewish year 5778, moving towards the new year of 5779. This has been a strange year indeed, and for some of us, it will be a year in which we will say lehitraot without regret. While most of us are now addicted to the incredible, unstoppable flow of wild and weird news stories that pour into our cell phones on a daily basis, the truth is that we are now in a period of time when in Jewish tradition we are commanded to look inward rather than outward, to evaluate our personal lives and conduct and see what we might improve in the coming year. In our tradition, this final Hebrew calendar month of Elul is the time to begin taking stock of our lives, examining our character and seeking to return to our families and friends and to the best that is within us. Over the course of this month, and even more in the 10 days of repentance from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, we endeavor to repair all that is damaged in our lives or has become damaged over the past 12 months. It's a challenging time of year, but also a very powerful one, filled with the potential to truly change our lives for good. Change is always challenging, even when it is for the better. Generally speaking, it's easier to do the same things over again the same way, always. We already know how to do what we've already done, after all, and even if the results aren't fulfilling or meaningful, they are predictable. That's why so many of us find it nearly impossible to make significant changes in our own personal lives and conduct. The ever-present danger is that we will do just what we have always done, and arrive next year at Rosh Hashanah to discover that we have made the same mistakes and yet again failed to improve our lives. No matter how much we say we're going to change, usually we don't. But that's not the Jewish way, nor is it the best way to live. Albert Einstein's definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Or, as the old joke goes, a man comes up to a hot dog stand that advertises Zen hot dogs. He figures he has to try one of these. So he goes to the hot dog vendor and says, "I'll take one with everything on it." The vendor gives him his hot dog and says, "That'll be $3. The man gives him a $20 bill. The vendor takes it, puts it in the cash box, and closes the box. "Hey," says the guy, "what about my change?" And the Zen hot dog vendor says, "Change must come from within." Change must come from within. Indeed, it must. And now is the time to begin that process, now and in the coming days of awe. This very special time of year gives us a chance to choose to live better, holier, more meaningful lives. All that we need to do is look in the mirror, honestly, and to see reflected there somebody who has the capacity to become more than she or he was in the last 12 months, and then to start to act to make that happen. It's a rare and beautiful opportunity, and it comes now. To play us in on this Elul morning, in preparation for the coming High Holy Day season, here's the Metropolitan Opera tenor and cantor Jan Pierce of blessed memory singing the classic High Holy Day prayer Avinu Malkeinu for Max Janowski's famous setting.
Avinu Malkeinu, Shma Koleinu, vino malcheno, fotono le fonnefo. O vino malcheno, ramolo leno, veio allo leno, veta.
That was cantor and operatic tenor Jan Pierce singing the classic prayer of the High Holy Day season, Avinu Malkeinu, Our Father, Our King, Forgive Us. Rosh Hashanah is just 2 weeks away now, beginning Sunday night, September 9th. Our guest this morning, Ehud Diskin, was in the Israel Defense Forces. He rose to the rank of colonel, left the military, got a PhD, and had a highly successful business career, and he has since become a best-selling author in Israel. His Israeli hit novel on the War of Independence just been translated into English, and it's dramatic and moving. Hear all about it and meet our guest, Ehud Diskin, when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. Ehud Diskin is a fascinating guy, a colonel who has lived, six or seven lives, actually. He has a new book out, which has just been translated from the Hebrew, Lone Wolf in Jerusalem, a bestseller in Israel. It's a novel, but certainly based in history. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning and good to be with you.
So, not every military officer becomes a novelist. Tell us a little bit about your journey, which I think is a fascinating personal biography, which you've written about in elsewhere.
Yeah, I wrote a book, Yes, It's Possible. It was published 3 years ago in English. And so about my life a little bit. I was born in besieged Jerusalem. I was 4 years old. I remember that we didn't have food. We have a lot of artillery. It's hard to imagine at this day when you see that Jerusalem is formally announced as the capital of Israel by the U.S. But it was at these days. We were afraid that the Jordanian will take over Jerusalem. And later I grew up like every Israeli. I went to the army and I was very patriotic. I became an officer. Then was 6 days war. And all the wars I fought against the Egyptian. And later it was the war of attrition. I was a commander of a company. And in the Yom Kippur War, I was in the reserve because I also studied. I'm a PhD in financial management, so slowly I studied. And when the war began, I went to the war, I volunteered. And luckily or not luckily, I found myself at the operation officer of the 1st Brigade to cross the Suez Canal. Under the command, the division commander was Ariel Sharon. And we won the war in the end. Later I became, with the rank, I became a colonel. I was also at a certain stage, I was running the organization, a fundraising called Libby, that helped soldiers to study, and I worked closely with the Prime Minister Menachem Begin. I also worked with Rabin, who was the godfather of one of my children, and of course with Ariel Sharon. And later I was a candidate to be a general, but they told me to wait. I wanted to do something else in life. And I went to business, and I married a Jewish woman from America, so I moved to the U.S. and I became a businessman. Let's say, can say that I did okay. So I wrote a few years my memoirs. It was not a bestseller, but it was an interesting book that people said it's interesting.
We'll have to take a brief break and come back hearing about the new novel, which is called Lone Wolf in Jerusalem. It's a great read, and it's a great story. We'll return in just a moment here on Too Jewish with Ehud Diskin. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, twojewishradio.com, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as subscribable podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Amir, our expert on Israel, our maven on Israel.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So let's talk about a term that gets bandied about called Israeli Americans. Now, there's different ways of saying that, but to you, what does the term Israeli American mean? You're a great example, right?
Right. So, you know, if you look at the papers and, you know, citizenship and passports and someone who basically holds both,
dual citizenship,
Israeli one and American one. Not that easy, though, to all Israelis, obviously. So the definition is an Israeli who either made, you know, not Aliyah, but immigrated to Israel, to the United States.
Immigrated
to the United States.
Now, there's a pejorative term, right? Yordim, you know, people that have come down in the world, left Israel,
correct,
to leave anywhere.
Correct. So that, you know, you're hitting a very sensitive point. It's okay. It's okay. But the thing is that, you know, Yored is going down.
Right.
So you make Aliyah, you go up, and Yored, you're going down. So basically, someone who left Israel, it's kind of like someone who went down, right?
Yeah.
And descended. Yeah. But really, as we have in the States, you know, we're in a melting pot, and we have the Italian American, Chinese American, and, you know, so far and so forth. So we have 800,000 Israelis.
800,000 Israelis.
That's the number who live in the United States.
Essentially full time.
Correct. And some of them were born here, you know, to parents who came from Israel. And some of them immigrated in a certain age.
So, by the way, some of those people who were born here are quite famous people. Natalie Portman, and I mean, there's a number
Gal Gadot, Wonder Woman.
Gal Gadot, Wonder Woman, right?
I know.
She's basically an Israeli-American now.
I know. No, you're right. There are a lot of examples, yeah. But basically, it's as I said, it's your dual citizenship. You have a home in Israel and you have a home in the United States.
So does that mean your heart is both places? I think of the famous Yehuda Halevi poem, you know, Libi b'Mizrach v'ani
I think so.
Ani b'Sof HaMarav, right?
As all of my friends and my family members who are Jewish Americans, who have in their hearts both the United States and Israel. So we have United States and Israel.
When you... Well, 800,000, that's roughly 12-14% of the population of Israel, right? So
right.
It's quite a lot.
It is a lot, yeah.
Are they Israeli Americans? I know that you're not concentrated in Tucson, Arizona. The concentrations are what? New York, Los Angeles, South Florida,
Miami,
of
Florida,
course.
Right, yeah. So basically, New York is a strong one. Miami is a strong one. LA, Los Angeles is a strong one. Palo Alto. Is a strong one for the high tech
right?
Silicon Valley, and yeah, no, those are the locations. I guess the weather, beside New York in the winter, right?
I don't know about New York, but the rest of them.
But the rest,
Boston, especially, I think, also a pretty strong Israeli population.
Correct.
So, in a way, it enriches both countries.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we really we are an asset, you know, to the relationship between the United States and Israel, the Jewish community in Israel. Absolutely.
Thanks so much. We will talk next week, Amir.
Thank you, Rabbi.
We are now pleased and serene to welcome back a recurring feature of Too Jewish, Deep Wisdom from Zen Judaism, Haikus for Jews. The sparkling blue sea reminds me to wait an hour after my sandwich. And like a bonsai tree is your terrible posture at my dinner table. Those were koans of Zen Judaism, two haikus for Jews. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
There have been a lot of stories in the news over recent months and even years about outlawing kashrut in Europe because of humanitarian concerns for the quickest form of slaughter. And it's problematic. It's also affected halal, Muslim, their version of kashrut. This isn't just a contemporary thing, of course.
And there's also one country that we think of as very progressive, where recently the practice of circumcision has come under attack, and
right.
Which may be banned.
Yep, that's
right. I don't
right.
remember. Is that Denmark?
It's in Scandinavia. It's either Sweden or Denmark. That's right.
Okay. So that one is probably easier to explain because the Europeans have become aware, as a result of the influx of Muslim immigrants, that a lot of Muslim cultures, and particularly African Muslims, engage in what they consider female circumcision, but the European Christians among whom they live consider it genital mutilation.
Right.
And it's the same procedure with different labels.
But it should be clear that it's not the same thing as circumcision. It doesn't have the same disastrous effect on men to circumcise them as it does to remove the clitoris, which is what the
right.
genital mutilation is.
You know, although there are people who, in their unshakable ignorance, would argue that too, that, you know, has a disastrous effect on men because they may not know what it's like to be circumcised.
Yeah, that's why there's so few Jews playing in the NBA, for example. It must be circumcision that caused that.
Right. But, I mean, there is a wider problem here. I think this speaks to the fact that, particularly in Europe, Jews who used to be forced to live in ghettos and about whose real daily lives their non-Jewish neighbors knew next to nothing have since the so-called emancipation that took place to varying degrees and with varying speeds sometime in the 19th century. But they've since sort of self-ghettoized, and they live with other Jewish friends. They socialize, they vacation, they play sports with other Jews. And they don't do a very good job of explaining what their religious practices are. So I think a lot of European Christians and even some European Jews consider circumcision to be barbaric and not a fundamental part of a Jew's relationship with God. And as far as shchita, the practice of kosher slaughtering,
ritual slaughter, right?
That's been outlawed since the Middle Ages in, for example, the Swiss Constitution. Hmm. We think of Switzerland as this haven for human rights and democracy and whatever. But by the founding document that created the Swiss Confederation, shchita is against the law. So Jews who want to observe kashrut and eat only kosher meat have to bring in their meat from nearby towns in France or Germany or Austria, where at least until now, kosher slaughtering is permitted.
Wow. So it's not a new problem. Interesting and complicated situation. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We are delighted to welcome two very special new contributors to Too Jewish. Our new, now you've heard the term shinshinim now for a while, a couple of years, and now we have shinshiniyot, that just means people who are doing their service to their country before going in the army, but we don't have a guy and a woman this time. We have two wonderful young women. I'm going to introduce them to you now, Rotem Rappaport and Ron Benacourt. And they are here with us this morning. Boker Tov, good morning, welcome.
Boker Tov.
And welcome to America. So, all right, tell us a little bit about your first impressions.
Tucson is beautiful. I really love it. I love the nature and desert. I think it's a beautiful place.
Yeah, and I'm just getting used to the heat over here.
Yeah, it's a little warm.
Yeah, a little warm.
Now, you guys are both from an area in the south of Israel that is not exactly cool itself in two ways. Obviously, it's a warm area in Chof Ashkelon, in the south there. It's near the desert, but it's also right on the border of Gaza. It's been a hot area. Talk a little bit about where you're from and that experience.
I live in Moshav Mafkim, which is about 7 kilometers. I'm not sure how it is on miles.
But 7 kilometers, yeah. Is 4.5 miles, something
okay,
like that.
Okay, so 4.5 miles from Gaza. And, you know, we're just living our life, keeping our routine as usual. We don't let it step in our way.
So, you know, the perception that Americans have is that there's missiles landing all over the place and everybody is always hiding in bunkers. That's not how you guys live your lives, right?
No, not at all. Our school is closer than my house to Gaza. And even if sometimes there's a little bit tension, we just keep our life as usual. And people live there all the time.
So, Ron, while we're talking with you, I'll ask you a very important question. What do your parents do?
Okay. Actually, I don't know how to say what my mom does.
Now, she works in the city hall, but she's not the mayor. She's not the
Rosh Ha'ir. No, she's not the mayor. She.
What's the Hebrew for what she does?
Mevakeret pnim.
So she kind of is like a city manager. She supervises people?
Yeah, something like that. I would say probably the closest thing that you guys have.
So she kept a pretty good eye on you and your brother growing up,
yeah,
I would assume.
Yeah, exactly.
And Rotem, tell me what your parents do.
My mom works in a kindergarten. And my dad is the manager of production in an oil factory.
So there's obviously oil industry where you guys are. And tell our two Jewish audience, Rotem, what are your interests besides obviously coming abroad and explaining about Israel?
I really like theater. I majored theater in high school, which is probably my favorite hobby.
I knew there was a reason I liked you. That was my thing in high school too.
And just, you know, I majored also social sciences in high school, which I love a lot, and I think I will be doing something with it in the future. Just getting to know people, talking to them.
Great preparation for what you're going to be doing all year.
Yeah.
And Ron, what are your interests?
I really love music. And I love to sing. I've been singing my whole life. I took it a little bit professional.
Me too.
Really? Good. That's great. I took it a little bit professional when I was at the 7th grade.
Wow.
Yeah. I started singing, you know, at school and different ceremonies. And I took singing classes.
We're going to have to hear you here on Too Jewish very shortly. Absolutely.
Okay, for sure. And I really love sport, all kind of sport games.
Well, you're in for a very great introduction to American sport, which is a little different than what you guys mostly have in Israel. Welcome, Bruchim Habayim. We're so delighted that you're here, and I hope it's a wonderful year.
Thank you so much. We're so happy to be here.
Thank you for having us.
You're very welcome. We'll talk next week. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. One day, the cantor, the Chazan, was bragging and boasting about the quality of his voice. He told the rabbi, "Do you know I even insured my voice for $1 million? And the rabbi replied, "So what did you do with the money?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. How do we go about changing our world, and how long should it take? Our Torah portion this week, Ki Tavo, gives us powerful commandments about how to live in society. We're commanded to be moral, to protect the rights of the impoverished, the widow, and the stranger. We're to be honest in business, careful of the needs of the hungry and the homeless. We are supposed to create a society of ethical practice and moral concern. We are to understand that a nation is judged by how it treats its weakest, neediest members. We're told repeatedly that God knows and expects us to live to this covenant, uphold it, cherish it, make it our own. And we are told of the blessings that will be ours if we can do this, and the curses we will bring on ourselves if we cannot. This covenant was extensive and challenging. It put real responsibilities on its members, its B'nai B'rit, to do things that weren't easy or obvious, because they were right. No doubt our ancient Israelite ancestors sometimes struggled when told to open your hands to the poor and needy, to welcome the stranger, to love your neighbor as you love yourself. Probably they didn't always give full tithes to the temple or make the pilgrimage to Jerusalem to declare gratitude for what they had. I'll bet there were times they didn't provide adequately for the widow and the orphan and the refugee either. But that challenge, the daily requirement to try to live to this standard, made them better people, made Jewish society in biblical times egalitarian and, generally speaking, ethical. And when our Israelite forebears failed to live up to this covenant, they learned that what God really wanted was not punishment but tshuvah, the return to the right course. Undoubtedly, positive societal change was not instantaneous, but evolutionary. It took time to take full effect, and longer still to institutionalize. But change for the better did eventually take place for our ancestors, and it was codified as a practical, ethical framework by the rabbis of the Talmud. It's appropriate to read Ki Tavo at this season of the year, during the last days of Elul, and also in the home stretch of an election campaign for many important offices. On a personal level, we must seek to improve our own lives, to become more generous and more grateful, to love those around us, to find our own tshuva. As a society, we Jews live well in an America that has shown the ability to evolve and change for the better. Today, at least officially, the rights of minorities, women, gays, lesbians, and many others are now accepted as fact. We have gone from a society in which many, if not most, blacks were prevented from even voting to a country in which our president for 8 years was an African American. We have gone from Jim Crow laws and open discrimination against Jews, Hispanics, Asians, and homosexuals to a society in which gays and lesbians can publicly marry most places, in which the Supreme Court of our nation actually kind of looks a bit like America. We have made true progress. Yet, we know that progress is not always permanent, and we still have a long way to go. The conflicts involving the rights and safety of African Americans have moved from large-scale demonstrations and riots to the realm of symbolic things like national anthems. But the problem remains. Recent tragic shootings remind us that LGBTQ groups remain the target of unlawful domestic terror attacks. Immigrants seeking freedom and opportunity in America remain an easy target for unreasoning hostility and official oppression and sometimes brutality.
But the process that Ki Tavo established so long ago and the direction of social change in our own country in the longer run teach us that with steady moral pressure mixed with some patience, injustice can indeed be overcome, and the society of justice, faith, and fairness that Deuteronomy demanded more than 2,500 years ago may still be created. May this be God's will, but more importantly, in this season, may it be our will. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Ehud Diskin, who has had an extraordinary life and several distinguished careers in Israel, will explore his best-selling novel of the birth of the State of Israel. Hear all about it when we return in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Two Iranian men were indicted last week for allegedly spying for Tehran in the U.S., including conducting surveillance at a Jewish facility and gathering information on backers of the Iranian opposition group known as Mujahideen Ekalk, or MEK, the Justice Department said last week. Ahmad Reza Mohammadi Dustdar, 38 years old, a dual U.S.-Iranian citizen, and Majid Ghorbani, 59 years old, an Iranian citizen and resident in California, were charged in the indictment with acting on behalf of Iran by conducting surveillance. The indictment alleges Dustdar traveled from Iran to the U.S. in July of 2017 to collect intelligence about entities considered to be enemies of the Iranian government, including Israeli and Jewish interests, as well as people associated with this opposition party, MEK. The Iranian agents were tasked with collecting intelligence on entities and individuals considered by the government of Iran to be enemies of the regime, including Israeli and Jewish interests. Dustdar and Ghorbani acted on behalf of Iran, conducting surveillance of political opponents and engaging in other activities that could put Americans at risk, said Assistant Attorney General for National Security John Demers. With their arrest and these charges, we are seeking to hold the defendants accountable. Jewish American organizations applauded the arrest. We commend and thank the FBI for disrupting the alleged intelligence-gathering efforts of the Islamic Republic of Iran, a nation with a long record of involvement in and support for terrorist attacks against Jewish and Israeli institutions, said Jonathan Greenblatt, the national director of the ADL. Cooperation among law enforcement and the people and communities they serve is essential to safeguard us from extremism and terror. The Justice Department said Dustdar conducted surveillance in July of 2017 on the Ror Chabad house in Chicago, including photographing its security features. Ghorbani attended an MEK rally in New York in September 2017. That rally was to protest the current Iranian government. He took photographs of the participants, later passed them on to Dustdar, who paid him about $2,000. The photos, many with handwritten notes about the participants, were found in Ghorbani's luggage at a U.S. airport as he returned to Iran in December 2017. Other alleged agents of Iran were recently arrested in Europe, accused of plotting a terror attack in the heart of Paris against an MEK rally held there earlier this summer. In other news, last week, PepsiCo purchased Israeli-based home carbonated drink maker SodaStream for over $3.2 billion. That acquisition is rather ironic, considering that about 10 years ago, SodaStream waged an aggressive campaign aiming directly at both the cola giants, Coca-Cola and, yes, PepsiCo. SodaStream's TV commercials actually had to be censored because of how directly they attacked Pepsi and Coke. SodaStream's branding is based on the health wave that has hit sugary drinks in recent decades and led to a considerable decline in their consumption. In 2012, SodaStream put up special recycling cages at various airports around the world and other places, including opposite Coke's headquarters in Atlanta, to illustrate how much plastic people consume when they drink Coke. Later, SodaStream produced a commercial in which Coke and Pepsi bottles are shown exploding. That clip was censored when it was broadcast during the Super Bowl after Coke complained of copyright infringement.
Like most actors, my real job is saving the world. Start with plain water, add bubbles, mix in the perfect flavor. Look, a soda that's better for you and all of us. Less sugar, less bottles. If only I could make this message go viral.
You doing it, Scarlett. Yeah, you doing it. Changing the world. One sip at a time.
Sorry, Coke and Pepsi.
Oh yeah, she done it. SodaStream.
Most famously, in 2014, SodaStream produced a commercial starring Jewish superstar actress Scarlett Johansson, which ended with the words, "Sorry, Coke and Pepsi." That one was censored too. SodaStream also mounted specific campaigns in London. Artists sculpted three statues out of sugar opposite Parliament to illustrate how much sugar a family consumes each year when they drink Coke and Pepsi. Scarlett Johansson was criticized for being the face of SodaStream. The company had a production plant in Mishor Adumim in the West Bank, and pro-Palestinian activists called for a boycott of the actress, if you remember. Scarlett Johansson, who was also a goodwill ambassador for the charity Oxfam, did not give in to the pressure and resigned from Oxfam after their criticism. The Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, BDS, which called for sanctions against Israel, particularly did so against products produced in West Bank settlements and still does. It made it a goal to attack SodaStream in the U.S. and Europe because of the plant in Mishor Adumim. That plant employed hundreds of Palestinian workers, ironically. Due to the pressure that the BDS movement brought to bear, SodaStream closed that plant and moved it to the Negev, where, of course, they employed Israelis rather than Palestinians, thus making sure there were more unemployed Palestinians. Another victory for BDS. BDS movement also claimed that thanks to its campaign, billionaire George Soros sold his stake in SodaStream. And yet, SodaStream bubbled on. SodaStream's great success is planted deeply in its clever advertising and marketing strategy for years, said Avi Zaitan, a marketing and strategic expert. In recent years, SodaStream commercials have featured Mayim Bialik of the Big Bang fame, a past guest of Too Jewish, where it once again raised the environmental benefit and savings by using SodaStream instead of buying flavored and carbonated water in the single-use plastic bottles like Coke and Pepsi. Well, better to buy them than get beaten by them, and now it has been sold to Pepsi for $3.2 billion. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Ehud Diskin, who's had a fascinating, interesting career both in the Israeli military with extensive experience with lots of important commanders and prime ministers, and then in the business world. And then he wrote his memoirs, and then he ended up, well, tell us about how this new book, Lone Wolf in Jerusalem, came about.
So I didn't have an intention to write another book, about 3 years ago, I read a blog of an Israeli 17 years old teenager that he wrote as follows. I don't care about Israel. I don't care about anyone here. I have more in common with someone in Germany. And just I will have the first opportunity, I'll run away from here. And I say to myself, it's okay, everyone can live wherever they want. But one thing that people, they don't appreciate the establishment of the state of Israel, that after 2,000 years, we have a state. And people are not aware what we went through. What I thought also, that usually people, they don't read history. So I thought to myself, If I can write a good novel, a good story, and tell also, include in it, the story of the establishment of the State of Israel, about the undergrounds before that they fought the British, so people will know the history. And I'm trying always to be honest with myself. I said, maybe I don't know to write such good stories, so it's okay, I'll write it and I'll put it in the trash afterwards and it's okay. So I wrote the story. I showed it to people that I trust and they said it's a great story. So I went to the largest publisher in Israel, Yediot Sfarim. They said also it's a good story and they published it and it became a bestseller. So people liked it.
It is based, of course, in historical events. Who did you base the protagonist on?
Who did you base the main character on?
Listen,
David.
It's based on my imagination, and I brought the story of someone. His name is David Gbinski.
David Gbinski. Who fights in Belarus in the resistance and then makes Aliyah, right?
Exactly. And he fights in Belarus, and he leads a courageous group of Jewish partisans. And later, he journeys to Israel, to Jerusalem. And then he found himself fighting with the British. They didn't allow survivors from the Holocaust to go back to immigrate to Israel. So the story is, the characters are imaginative, but the history in the book, it's really very precise.
There used to be some great novels based on the founding of the State of Israel, you know, the early years. I think O Jerusalem, there were some others. I'm sure you're familiar with them. This is a little different. It's quicker. You know, there's a great pace to the novel. Was that intentional?
Yeah, what usually when I'm writing, I think about the reader. I want that the reader will enjoy the book. I didn't make it too complicated. And and I try to put the history, not too much history, because I see in my eyes not only the story, I imagine the reader that he will like what I'm writing, that it will be interesting, it will not be too long. And the book is suspense, you have it's romantic also. There is a love story between this David Gbinski and Shoshana. She was also a survivor of the Holocaust. And they are fighting the British. If I can tell you something, it's when I made the book launch, I wanted to invite in Israel, I wanted to invite people from the undergrounds, from all undergrounds. There were three undergrounds, the Haganah, the Yorgun, and the Lehi. So I invited the son of Moshe Sneh, Ephraim Sneh, that he is a general. He's a general, retired. He's also a doctor. He was also a minister. And he wrote me politely an email. You know what, I cannot come. I will be traveling. I said, fine. I found someone else to give a speech in the book launch. But 2 days before the book launch, I got an email from him. He said, listen, I just got back from Poland, and I read your book there. First of all, it's a fascinating book, but you are the only one, one of the only ones, that wrote precisely the history and also about my father, and I'm going to come to the book launch and also to say it. I wrote like a few lines about his father, and he came and he said it. I tried that the history will be very precise also there, and it not be too much history.
Now, there's still, I mean, sorry, I'm a history person, so I have to come back to the history. People don't remember how complicated the early history of Israel is. You know, we think of the IDF now, we see a powerful military, the most successful military in the Middle East, one of the most successful in the world. It wasn't organically, it didn't happen organically, right? There were a lot of events that go into that, and some of them are kind of played out in this book.
Yeah. I tried to write the history, as I said, right? And there were three undergrounds, and on a personal level,
and I should note, of course, you know, as part of the British Empire, while Jews certainly fought for the British in World War II, after the war, all of those militaries, you know, went back underground. They couldn't, they weren't theoretically allowed to organize, and yet they had to create some ability to defend Jews as independence loomed. So just a little fill in a little bit there.
Yeah, thank you, Rabbi. You see, what I admire all these people, because it's not like today. You see, I was in the army. Every Israeli he has to go to the army and to serve and so on. All these people that sacrifice their life, endanger their life, they could sit quietly. But they volunteered and they did tremendous things. You know, I couldn't tell everything in my book, but if you read it, you see how they sacrifice themselves, and they were really heroes. And what I want to add, one more thing, is people today, as I said, they don't appreciate the establishment of the State of Israel. It's like it's nature. It's everyone is this way. Like you go to a new house, new apartment. In the beginning, everything is fascinating. Afterwards, you are going to find this is wrong, this is wrong. Same about relationship between a couple. In the beginning, everyone is great, and then you begin to find. Same about Israel. That, of course, not everything is okay, but today they are concentrating only, not only, but a lot in what's wrong. Like, I'll give maybe an example. Israel today, they have all these Syrian refugees that no one cared about them in Syria, and 500,000 Syrians were killed. So Israel helped. So people are not paying a lot of attention about it. But when they put now in jail an Arabic lady, Palestinian lady, that she hit an officer, you know, all the media is writing about it.
Right. It doesn't matter how many Syrians are murdered in the civil war, but one incident in Israel. Yes, of course. The founding of the State of Israel was, I don't think it's possible to capture how dramatic and miraculous that seemed to Jews in 1948, maybe to everyone in the world. And yet it wasn't accomplished by miracle. It was accomplished by the kind of stories that you tell in your book. Do you think young Israelis need to hear that now?
I think it's very important. You see, in Israel, a lot of people, they told me that it's a must that every Jew will read this book, you know, because it's very, people are not aware, you know, and when people are reading it, I give also speeches. The book was also translated into Russian, and Nathan Sharansky, he wrote an introduction. He liked the book very much, and I gave a speech in Israel to Russian people. And afterwards, I will not read you the email now. I got an email for a lady that she was in the. She listened to my speech, and I saw she was a little bit against Israel and so on. So I received this email from this Russian lady, and I'll read it to you. Dear Ehud, my name is Ksenia. Couple of weeks ago, I have been to the representation of your book, Lone Wolf in Jerusalem, that took place in Babel, Tel Aviv. I bought the book that day, and you even signed it for me, which I appreciate a lot. I read this book in 2 days, thanks to espresso and sleepless night, but didn't want to bother you with my letters. Meanwhile, I am still under great impression, and that's the reason why I cannot help in writing you a letter of thanks. Despite the fact that this is not a book of history, it helped me to put everything in its place in my head and forced me to change my point of view to Israel itself, the miracle of the fact that the state appeared at all. All the difficulties, losses, and pain people had to go through in order it to happen. It's not that I didn't know it before, but the book touched some deeper layers in my soul. I went through thousands of emotions while reading those pages, and I just wanted to say thank you for it. It was great. Okay, Ksenia, that's it.
you felt the responsibility in writing this book, didn't you?
Yeah. I felt the responsibility because a lot of people told me that they were not aware. They were not aware what happened. And if people will read the book, they will understand. But you see more that she couldn't put the book. It's suspense and it's romantic. You know, all the relationship and it's. Again, I tried that the readers will like it.
It's a great read. By the way, lots of quick action, lots of real-life violence, I might also add. It's war. And I think it exposes a lot of aspects of the founding of the state that not everybody would remember or recall. I want to thank Ehud Diskin for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you, Ehud?
They can look at Amazon. My book, first book, Yes, It's Possible, still sells on Amazon. And today you Google, you find everything.
You find everything about everybody.
Exactly.
And you definitely want to read Lone Wolf in Jerusalem. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rabbi Salomon.
When we come back here on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with me this morning on Two Jewish. I'm Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Two Jewish. Our guest will be Alan Appel, author of The Book of Norman. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TwoJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from the chief cantor of the Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, the extraordinary cantor and singer, Brigadier General Avigdor Kahalani, singing Unetana Tokef, Behold the Great Power and Holiness of This Day of Rosh Hashanah, coming up 2 weeks from tonight and tomorrow. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Unetana Tokef Kedushat Hayom Hu nora veayo vot inase malchutecha vikol bechesed kisecha veteshev alav bemet veteshev alav bemet. Emet ki ata hu dayan u mochiyach v'yodea v'ed v'zutev v'chotem v'sofer hu monen v'tizkor kol hanishkacho v'tiftach et sefer hazichrono. Shofar gadol itaka v'kol demamad haka yishama u'malachim yechafezu v'chil re'ada yofezu u'malachim yechafezu.
sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.